Straight Talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
Well, today we're going to be talking about cancel culture, censorship, and the possible end of democracy as we know it. You know, there's a blame game going around right now. Blame from the highest offices in the world, from the American White House and the Israeli Knesset, that those who don't wish to get injected with an experimental formula into their bodies are endangering others and even possibly killing others. But if everyone else is vaccinated, what do they have to worry about from others who chose not to get vaccinated at this juncture? You know, our guest in the show today writes this: people not only have a right, but an obligation to debate what their government does. Their opinions may be right or wrong, but that's not for Fauci and the government to decide. The only thing unhealthier than a virus is big government. That was written by Daniel Greenfield. He's an investigative journalist, and he's going to be joining me on the show today. Now, I don't know what his stance is on the vaccine issue specifically, but we're going to be talking about censorship by the government and the the social medias who are working hand in hand with the government, and cancel culture that comes into censorship as well. And if this is indeed is true, then this is a possible end of democracy, at least as we knew it growing up. So if you have any comments or questions, feel free to call in. Our numbers are on the top of our homepage at IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com. At the very top of the homepage in the middle, you will see at the top of the page there our phone numbers. You can call in with any comments or questions. We're going to be talking again about cancel culture, censorship, and the possible end of democracy as we know it. We'll be right back.
Israel is located in one of the most volatile areas in the world. Israel is an island of stability in a sea of war and unrest. In the midst of this turmoil, Israel stands out as a beacon of order and human progress. Each week we update you on what's happening in this, the Jewish state, a true light unto the nations. This is Jay Shapiro. Join me every Thursday on Israel News Talk Radio.
Right, so we're talking today about cancel culture, censorship, and the possible end of democracy as we know it, at least. And we've seen so many changes lately, and this is very worrisome. Our guest is Daniel Greenfield. He is a Shulman journalism fellow at the David Horowitz Freedom Center. He's an investigative journalist covering Islamic terrorism, American politics, the radical left, and world affairs. And his articles are published daily at frontpagemagazine.com and his own blog at danielgreenfield.org. So I want to welcome to the show Daniel Greenfield.
Thank you. It's very much an honor.
I'm thrilled to have you on with me. I was on your Facebook page yesterday, and you wrote an article talking about how Anthony Fauci is demanding censorship to fight the pandemic. And you wrote something which I just I loved, and I actually copied it and shared it, and I credited you. And you say here that people not only have a right, but an obligation to debate what their government does. Their opinions may be right or wrong, but that's not for Fauci and the government to decide. The only thing unhealthier than a virus is big government. So I don't know where you stand on the vaccine issue, if you are for forcing people to get vaccines or for people having the freedom to choose not to. I don't know where you are there. Maybe if you want to share it, you can. But there is a blame game going on recently that I've seen the new president, Biden, say that everyone's got to get vaccinated. And here in Israel with our new prime minister, Naftali Bennett, saying the same thing, basically blaming people who don't get vaccinated, that they could kill people and it's their fault if we go under lockdowns again, etc. And there are some people who are saying, look, we want more data before we decide to take this experimental vaccine. And in the meantime, when people want to post information about questions about this mRNA experimental vaccine, they're censored on the social media. They get strikes on YouTube, etc. Warnings that if they post anything like this in another once or twice, they could be kicked off. And we're seeing this censorship taking place. So with all of this that I've presented to you, where would you like to start?
Well, first of all, medical decisions are personal. They're not something that the government should be able to dictate to you. We've seen where that leads, for example, in Europe with euthanasia through the Liverpool care pathway, for example, through the National Health Service. In the UK, you've seen the recent case, a number of these actually, of just babies, parents who want their babies to be able to get treatment outside the UK and are prevented from doing so. Most recent case actually involving Israel. That's really where the government being able to control all your medical decisions ultimately takes us. It takes us to euthanasia. It takes us to murder. I mean, we've seen this before. Now, obviously, people should be able to make their own personal decisions. They should also live with the consequences of those decisions. That's what people in a free society do. My thrust is not discussing what people's medical decisions should be. My thrust is discussing what government should be doing in order to leave people alone. And this is the latest of the series of free speech crises created by the Democrats, beginning with Hillary Clinton, then with the Biden administration, in which they insist that there is some sort of crisis created by misinformation, by disinformation, by which they mean people just saying things. Now, you know, people have the right to say things. They have the right to say things that are right. They have the right to say things that are wrong. People have the right to legitimately or illegitimately criticize something because, you know, the bottom line is, when the government restricts speech, it ends up restricting good speech and bad speech. When you put the government in charge of deciding what is good speech and what is bad speech, then good speech will inevitably be wiped out by the government's own bad speech. This is what we've seen in dictatorships around the world.
Okay. So knowing that there are people who are posting as we thought that we had free speech, and yet we're being censored. And I used to have a guest on. She unfortunately passed away recently, but she would always say that the Constitution, the U.S. Constitution, is only as strong as the people willing to go out and defend it. And we're seeing the freedoms being eroded away. And there are people who are against it, but they're not going out into the streets. They're not stopping it. So, you know, how do people preserve their rights?
Well, the most obvious and most basic way is they preserve their rights by exercising them. When we exercise our rights, it's like muscles. You exercise your muscles, you stay in shape. You exercise your rights get stronger for exercising them. When we're told that we need to waive our rights because there's a state of emergency, well, you know, the state of emergency becomes a permanent state of emergency and somehow it never goes away. That's, again, what we've seen in the Soviet Union and other places. The Democrats declared a state of emergency in 2016 because they claimed there was a crisis of election interference. And then it moved from one crisis to another. Now we are in a crisis of medical misinformation. You know, there's always going to be a crisis that justifies shutting down free speech, that justifies shutting down the right of assembly. There were protests against lockdowns before the whole Black Lives Matter riots, and those were quickly suppressed because it was too dangerous to allow people to protest, even in cars. And then, of course, you had tens of thousands of leftists gathering to riot, and that was no longer dangerous. So the application of these rules is very much selective, which, of course, creates mistrust. It makes it very obvious that people are paying attention, that the rules are only going to be applied one way, that only certain kinds of speech, the kind that the government doesn't like, is going to be considered dangerous.
Right. I remember a meme going around saying that if you allow the government to take away your rights in an emergency, they'll keep creating emergencies to take away your rights. We do have a caller. Let's go to Alan from the Settlement of New York. Hi there, Alan. What's
Good
your
morning,
comment,
everyone.
Question? Go ahead.
So, you know, here's a funny thing that's not even being mentioned. When Donald Trump was president, these very same people said they would never trust any vaccine under his administration. But now that Joe Biden is president, all of a sudden these vaccinations are 100% foolproof. And if you don't take them, then you're just an anti-vaxxer. And you have to wonder, if Trump was president today, would the media be taking his side that everyone should get vaccinated, or would they say you can't trust it because it's Donald Trump?
Well,
that's a very good point. And we got a preview of that. We got a preview with that of Kamala Harris warning against the vaccine. We had major nurses unions, including NNU, which was the biggest nurses union in California, which was calling it a dangerous experimental vaccine. So, we've already seen this kind of double standard at play. There's absolutely no question that the media would be doing everything possible to prevent any kind of reopening. So, yes, they would be undermining the vaccine with the same level of enthusiasm that they're now promoting it.
All right, Alan, thank you so much for your call. Really appreciate it. And so that brings us to let's talk about the radical left now, since we're talking about how they were, the media was always with the left. It seems that they're groomed by the left before they even, get their jobs in the media. That's what it seems like. But, where would you like to start with the radical left?
Well, there's a kind of a common denominator. The radical left tries to pretend that it's new and edgy. In practice, it's been around for centuries. In whichever country it operates in, it always pushes the same agenda, which is create instability. Find groups that appear to be on the outs, weaponize them, turn them into fifth columns, manufacture these claims of oppression and use them to seize power. Everything really that we are seeing in any country follows the same exact pattern with minor variations as depending on the circumstances. But the tactics, the basic tactics remain the same. And they're very much about creating fear in certain kinds of people, creating the sense that you will be destroyed. You will be prevented from functioning in society, from having a livelihood, if you don't go along.
But hasn't the right, the extreme right, done that as well?
Well, it depends on how you define that, define the extreme right, which extreme right you're talking about.
Well, let's take Hitler, for instance. Hitler also made, the scapegoats, and it's because of these people that don't have money, etc.
So, yes, if you mean people like the Nazis, then yes, that's not something that really exists in the United States within that kind of context, not something that really exists within Israel. But the Nazis were very much inspired by Marxists, they've got socialists right in their name. They're the National Socialists. And Hitler, in this private conversations, discussed drawing inspiration from the left. The Nazis used black and red because they borrowed the red from the Marxists. They borrowed a lot of the tactics, which included class warfare. And obviously, terrorizing people is just a common denominator for totalitarians, for oppressive regimes. You will have Muslim regimes very much doing it in the Middle East. You will have Saddam Hussein. You will have Iran Shiite regime doing this. So it's not unique to any particular faction. This is just what you want to do when you want to terrorize people.
Mm-hmm. All right. So we have the radical left that's taking, rising in the United States. We see that with the what do they call them? The You know, AOC, they call them the three women.
The squad,
right. Okay, we see that there, and we see with BLM, and we see with the Antifa, et cetera, the radical left there really gaining power, and maybe we'll talk about that when we get back. I also want to ask you a bit about anti-Semitism that comes with that, and cancel culture that goes with the radical left's trying to change America, American Marxism, and, of course, critical race theory. We're going to try to cover all those subjects when we get back from our break. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
The Tamar Yonah Show.
Tamar, she's sassy.
She's smart.
She's funny.
But she's also a real Jewish mother.
Hi, everybody. I'm Tamar Yonah. And yes, I can be all of those things, but at Israel News Talk Radio, I'm here to bring you the news stories and guests that you may not hear anywhere else. Join me live on air Sundays, Mondays, and Tuesdays for the most unique and bold talk radio in Israel.
The Tamar Yonah Show.
Shalom, I'm Leah Aharoni. Join me on my show, News from the Torah. Each Sunday, we'll use the weekly Torah portion as a prism for understanding the news today. Listen to News from the Torah to gain clarity about the times we're living in and to understand your own spiritual path in the process. News from the Torah, every Sunday on Israel News Talk Radio.
All right, we are back here at the Tamar Yonah Show on IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com, and we are talking about cancel culture, censorship, and the possible end of democracy, at least as we knew it. And our guest is Daniel Greenfield. He's a Shulman Journalism Fellow at the David Horowitz Freedom Center. He's an investigative journalist, and you can find him at his website at danielgreenfield.org, and you can find his articles, which are published daily at Front Page Magazine or frontpagemag.com. All right, in the last segment, Daniel, we were talking about the radical left in the United States, which is really growing a lot, taking a lot of power, and we're seeing what's called cancel culture taking place, where they're basically erasing the history and they're rewriting history, and now they're teaching what's called CRT, which is critical race theory. Where would you like to go with that?
Well, we've seen cultural revolutions before. Very arguably, cultural revolutions are always part of leftist revolutions, whether it was the French Revolution, where they decided to throw out much of what France was. We've saw it, obviously, in the Soviet Union. We saw it in Cambodia. We saw it in China, obviously, which gave us the term cultural revolution. We're now seeing it, unfortunately, in the United States. Kind of thing has two thrusts, one of which is to, first of all, erase the past, to create the idea that everything in the past was terrible and needs to be replaced, which, again, is really fundamentally about giving the left total power, because once you set out this idea that everything in the past is to be replaced, then the left is now in charge of replacing everything. And the second of which is always to create this false idol, this false analogy, which is that everything has to be absolutely ideal or it's evil. If everybody in the past wasn't perfect, everything has to be gotten rid of and replaced with this kind of idea, which of course is always the left can never actually deliver. So what their argument comes down to is that the perfect has to be the enemy of the good. Everything in the past was not good enough. It will be perfect, but of course we're going to have to purge everything in the past. We're going to have to suppress, repress, and oppress a lot of people. And eventually we're going to have to kill a lot of people. And of course, that's never actually going to take us to utopia, but that's the justification for destroying countries, for destroying families, for destroying society.
Right. So I want to comment on that, because you would think that the younger generation who is being, radicalized to the left and communism and socialism, etc., would look at other countries that have instituted it, because on paper, communism sounds great. Everything's going to be equal. There aren't going to be any filthy rich people and any filthy poor people. We're all going to be the same. It sounds like utopia, like you said, but in actuality, it's never like that. And as you said, Russia killed millions upon millions of people, and China and Cambodia and all of these places. You look at Cuba, how poor they are, etc. So and you said that the left can never deliver, which I think is also a really great sentence from you. And so you would think that the right or the conservatives in the United States, who have always been talking about the evils of communism and how we have to fight it, would know that they are going to try to indoctrinate our youth, will know that they are ruthless, and that they would have prepared, just as the radical left have been grooming the next generation and the teachers and the professors that have hold of our children, that the conservatives should have been doing the same thing, but they've lost.
Well, you're kind of getting at a center point of it, which is that this very much appeals to the young who already have no sense of history, to whom you can't just necessarily point to the past by way of explaining why this is a terrible idea. It's why you have older people who tend to be more conservative and younger people who tend to be more radical. And the left understands that, and their cultural programming very much plays into this rebellion image, plays into hipness and coolness, plays into this idea that we have to get rid of the past. Your parents don't know anything. Now, competing with that directly is obviously challenging just message-wise, because you're taking a message of tradition, you're pitting it against the message of revolution. If you're older, then the message of tradition can actually prevail against revolution. If you're 16, if you're 22, and these days 22-year-olds are in many cases like 16-year-olds, then the message of tradition over revolution doesn't necessarily play all that well. And conservatives try to find ways to reach younger people, but very often they don't, because part of really what is appealing about tradition, about conservatism, is actually going out, making your own way, and actually learning some difficult lessons. I've had a friend who would say that that her friends were leftists until they actually began going to work and seeing just how much of their paycheck the government would take. I mean, you have to have a certain amount of life experience for leftist messages not to be quite that appealing. And this is something that the left makes perfect use of. It gets into that space, it gets into that period when the youth is indeed very radical. And then, of course, it does the same thing with the next generation, the one after that. The second point, which you've made, is really structural, which is that the left controls institutions. It takes control of institutions, like educational institutions. And what I've always told conservatives who say, well, what can we do about the education system? Well, you actually have to do what the left does, which is go into it and become teachers, become administrators, organize within the system. And of course, very few actually want to do it. When you talk about conservatives, particularly Eastern America, it's very often people who are in the middle class who are not interested in going into government, into public service, even into education. It's not quite the same situation within religious communities, but within the general conservative strain, you have people who are working hard. They don't want to do this kind of work. The left is very happy to do this kind of work.
Right. You know, it reminds me what you're saying about the younger generation not knowing history and wanting to, being attracted to radicalism and changing things. There's a quote by an author named G. Michael Hopf who says, "Hard times create strong men. Strong men create good times. Good times create weak men, and weak men create hard times." I just really feel like this is where we've come to, that our youth today are just weak because they've had everything, kol tuv, as they say in Hebrew. Knowing all of this and where we are today, and seeing the cancel culture going around, and there's a book that Mark Levin just wrote called American Marxism, and that's coming into play today with the radical left, as you know, this is basically the same thing. And they're teaching another thing to divide people And that's the CRT, the critical race theory. Do you want to tell us about that?
So critical race theory isn't really new. It fuses Marxism with racial black nationalism. Its premise, again, is kind of what I got at, which is the idea that everything in the past was evil. Within the American context, what it does is treat racism, slavery, and they equate the two as America's original sin. All of America was originally based on racism. And what they do in the present day, even though really they've tried to keep this whole racism idea going, even though there's really very little in the way of racism, there's no systemic racism, certainly not directed at black people, but they will insist that all racial disparities are the result of racism. This is a position that's been advocated by a guy named Ibram X. Kendi, who's become one of the big figures in what they call anti-racism, which effectively means that anytime you have any racial differences in average income and life expectancy between black and white people, it's automatically proof that there exists systemic racism. And of course, there's got to be this push to further privilege and advantage a particular population in order to create equity, which of course is, I mean, this is basically the revival of the whole class warfare stuff that we were seeing in communist countries, because you're aiming at a goal that is completely impossible, that is never going to be reached, precisely because it creates a massive political system that is going to be in charge of everybody's lives permanently.
So, you know, you're saying that they're claiming that, you know, if one part of us of a segment of a population isn't making as much money, isn't as successful, etc., that it's racism. But it doesn't have to be. I mean, why aren't we learning that? It could just be that certain populations with their cultures just have different values, you know. Here in Israel, they could say that Israelis are racist, that we hate the Arabs because the Arabs don't make as much money as the Israelis do, which is not true, by the way. I've seen very, very, very wealthy and rich Arabs. Mm-hmm. But as a generality, you can say, look, the Arabs don't value education and the same things that the Israelis do. I mean, the Israelis built the first Arab university for the Arabs here in Israel. They didn't even have a university because they never felt it a need to do that for their people, where Israel is saying, look, you know, let's educate you, let's bring you up. And it wasn't racism, the opposite. We were trying to help, and yet it's just a cultural thing. What would you have to say about that?
That's exactly true. Look, everybody makes decisions, and those decisions have consequences, as I said early on. When it comes to the United States, you had people, everybody who came here was pretty much a member of some sort of oppressed group, whether it was the Jews, the Irish, the Italians, the Germans after the 1848 revolution. People from a variety of backgrounds came here, the huddled, teeming, wretched masses yearning to be free. They overcame that. They prospered, they struggled, and they succeeded. And that's the bottom line. Those are decisions you make. Not everybody succeeded. And that's also a decision that people make. This entire idea of systemic racism, the idea of dividing the population into black and white, is a false dichotomy. It's a false dichotomy in the United States. It's a false dichotomy around the world. You will see Chinese immigrants showing up in the United States. You will see them showing up for
Hang on. We got to go to a break. We're going to be right back. I'm going to ask you about how we get out of this abyss. We'll be right back.
In a time where feelings have become fact, where rational thought and common sense has disappeared, one man stands above it all.
I'm Howie Sobiker, your political hitman.
Political Hitman airs every Tuesday at 11:59 p.m. North American time, 7 a.m. Israeli time, only on Israel News Talk Radio.
Are you interested in transforming your life, drawing closer to the Creator, and uncovering the deeper meanings and hidden treasures in the Hebrew Bible?
Then join me, Rav Yitzhak Michelson.
And me, William Hall.
On The Science of Kabbalah, where we are seeking to narrow the gap between what we understand of our physical and spiritual worlds. So make sure to tune in every Tuesday at 5 p.m. Israel time, 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, here on Israel News Talk Radio.
right, we are back here at the Tamar Yonah Show on IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com. And I want to read out a quote that our guest said, just because I love it so much, I have to read it again. People not only have a right, but an obligation to debate what their government does. Their opinions may be right or wrong, but that's not for Fauci and the government to decide. The only thing unhealthier than a virus is big government. Our guest is Daniel Greenfield. He's an investigative journalist. You can find his articles on Front Page Magazine or on his blog at danielgreenfield.org. So, Daniel, we were talking about the radical left, American Marxism, critical race theory, and how they divide people to hate each other in order to take power. And that's what one of the things I remember my parents used to teach me, because my father fought the British in the 1948 War of Independence here in Israel. He's a Holocaust survivor. And after he came here, the British caught him on the ship and they put him in a DP camp in Cyprus. And he was able finally to get into Israel. And then they fought the British to leave the land of Israel. And they often taught me how the British, wherever they would go, they would always try to divide the population, whether it was Israel, whether it was India. They did it in India as well, to pit this one against that one so they would forget about the British. And then the British would be in control and they would help each side and then take control by helping each side or one side. So knowing this, you were telling me over the break that there's something called racial pessimism. Can you tell us about that?
Well, it's really about how you see the world. There are people who see the glass as half full and glass as half empty. There are people who see other people as basically being good. There are people who see other people as being basically racist. What we're actually seeing from racial surveys of race relations in the United States, is that the people who are the most concerned about racism are the people who anticipated, who see most people already as racist. And it's interesting because, for example, Hispanics in America tend to see race relations positively, whereas Black people tend to see race relations negatively. And as Black people, for example, will rate relations between white people and Hispanic people negatively, even though it has nothing to do with them, whereas Hispanics tend to rate it positively. So racial pessimism really is a conspiracy theory. It's the mindset that says other people around you are out to get you and you should distrust them. And you should do something about them before they do something to you. It's a very tribal mentality. And it's behind a lot of the conflicts in the United States and around the world.
So I'm just going to play devil's advocate for a moment and say, you know, can't you give the benefit of the doubt to some of the Blacks? You know, I mean, their skin color is much, they don't blend into the white majority as well as the Latinos do. And so and they were slaves when they were brought to the United States. So couldn't you like understand them?
Well, you know, if you visit a major American city, whether it's New York or Los Angeles recently, it's very easy to see that the white majority is very much a fiction. You have an incredible array of diversity, a bewildering one that would confuse anybody from 40, 50 years ago. In major American cities, there's no white majority. In many of those cities, you have Black mayors, you have Black police chiefs, you have Black leaders running most things. The white majority is very much a fiction, but it's a fiction that has to be kept going because there's money to be made, because there's power to be seized, and because people can be divided, as you mentioned early on. Empires do practice divide and conquer, so do ideologies. When the left comes in, it very much focuses on groups that it can actually use to wage war against other groups. It creates suspicion, it creates fear, and it exploits this kind of tribalism to turn people against each other for its own benefit.
Right. You know, and I do want to say here that America is probably the and Israel, I would put it in the same thing, the least racist country in the world. I mean, they elected a Black president twice, okay? So that's not racist to me at all, but go figure. Okay, so let's talk about how we get out of this muck. We are in a place now where there is the state of emergency of a pandemic, and the governments are, as you said before, in emergency, you know, making emergency laws for emergencies that we're in, and it's life, it's life threatening, etc. And we have to do this. And, you know, or with the terrorism, they're listening in on people's phone calls because they have to check for terrorists, etc. Or they have to listen, or they have to track your phones to see if you were near somebody who had corona. I mean, we had that here in Israel. I mean, my girlfriend, when we got corona, I was walking with her before I knew I had it. We walked together. However, we were we were 6 feet, 2 meters away. And she got a notice on her phone that she was with someone, they didn't say, that between this time and this time of day, that has corona, and she has to go into immediate isolation for the next 2 weeks. So she called them and said, what are you talking about? And blah, blah, blah. And she was able to get out of it because we were never near each other. We walked, but we were very far from each other. But they do these things under the quote unquote emergency need. And we've seen this eroding of our rights. How do we get them back?
Well, there are multiple answers to that. The first we kind of addressed early on, you actually have to stand for your rights. And this intersects with the whole idea of cancel culture. You have to stop living in fear. You actually have to do what makes sense for you instead of actually being driven by what you're being told. And people are very much being driven crazy by what they're seeing on the news, what they're seeing in the media, what they're seeing on social media. This is really defining people's lives. The second, which you also kind of got at, is a lot of big tech, a lot of the technology that surrounds us, which to some degree we value because it's seemingly free, is really spying on us. It's monitoring us. It's being used to control us by massive, massive companies, the FANG big tech monopolies particularly, who have untold wealth and who are increasingly intersecting with the government. So in some degree, we are actually the ones putting the chains on ourselves. When we have the smartphone and we let the smartphone spy on us because, well, Android and Apple are very convenient, well, to some degree, we are becoming complicit in that. And there are alternatives. There are ways to prevent this kind of monitoring. We're just not really choosing to do it because it would inconvenience us. And that's also really a part of the bigger thing that's going on. We're not the wretched and the oppressed. We're not the people who are in chains. Rather, we're the people living in fairly comfortable societies. We have a lot of the comforts and conveniences because we've accepted that we're going to lose some of our rights along the way. We lose our privacy. We trade away our data. We trade away information about ourselves. And this allows government to increasingly dictate to us how we live. And that's a basic question that we have to address. Is our convenience worth our rights?
Okay, so I'm going to guess that people are not going to give up their cell phones. And just because the government can, or these big tech companies can spy on you, doesn't mean that they should. I mean, people can go and kill other people, but that doesn't mean that we should. We can go and steal and shoplift, but that doesn't mean that we should. And we can spy on people, but that doesn't mean that we should. And we don't have to. So can't we have a culture where we can feel relatively safe and have our privacy while still having these things? Because just as we shouldn't steal or kill, just because you can, we shouldn't be spied on. And do we have to? I mean, is that the answer? If everybody now gave up their cell phones, do you think that would be the answer? It would just cut us off from being able to communicating with other people.
No, I'm not suggesting that everybody give up their smartphones. There are, again, ways to do things to your phones that would actually, and this is a matter that can be researched easily enough, that would prevent this kind of monitoring. Again, most people don't go to the trouble of doing that. They also use services that they don't need to because they're free. But again, that would be a whole topic for its own show. As far as what the government should do, what huge companies should do, the problem is when you have something that is very powerful, whether it's government or a company, you don't get to tell it should. It gets to tell you what you should do, and that's just a basic reality. This is why the United States was built on the idea of making government small and controllable. When government gets big, it's uncontrollable. When a company gets so big, for example, Facebook controls 80% of social media. Google controls 80% of search. When a company has this much power and scope, then it tells you what to do. That's just a basic reality. To have freedom, for people to have freedom, you have to have entities governments, companies that are small enough to be controllable. When they're too big, they control you.
Okay, so you're saying that if people want privacy, they're going to have to get rid of their high technology, their cell phones, their Alexas, et cetera, et cetera.
No. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that people do actually have to research how those devices can be modified. They have to look for alternatives. Software-wise, there are alternatives.
Okay, I mean, you know what? We'll have to do a show on that because I'm very curious about what you're saying. So besides that, how do we get our rights back? Is there a chance? Can we get our rights back? Or are they gone and it's going to take another few generations until things get so bad that they're going to want to revolt?
No, I mean, rights are a tug of war. It's a matter of checks and balances, just like within the government, within the society. People actually have to want their rights. They actually have to demand their rights. They have to push their rights. When people start taking their rights for granted, it becomes very easy to lose them. So it's like a tug of war. The government pulls. You have to be able to pull back. Powerful organizations pull. You, again, have to be able to pull back. And this is a basic form of exercise that keeps a society healthy. It doesn't solve all the problems. Once there is a really strong, vital totalitarian state, then pulling back isn't necessarily enough. But as we've seen even in the Soviet Union, what's possible when people actually do fight for their rights. So many Soviet Jews became refuseniks. So many of them actually went out to Simchat Torah to sing and dance despite the consequences. And they did it. And in the end, they prevailed. So many of them are now living in Eretz Israel today. So it's very important not to despair, not to give up hope, not to assume that everything is done, because the basic reality is, as long as we are willing to push, to pull for our rights, it's not done. It's not over.
All right. Well, we have to end it there. Daniel Greenfield, thank you so much for coming on the show. Remember, danielgreenfield.org is his website. Thank you for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for a great conversation.
Where can you get the inside news on Israel? At Israel News Talk Radio, we're dedicated to sharing Israel's inside story with the world by providing our listeners with news on Israeli politics, current affairs, and Israeli Jewish culture. The Israel News Talk Radio homepage also provides you, the listener, with useful information at your fingertips, with scrolling news headlines, weather, currency exchange, Shabbat candlelighting times, and so much more. Our radio programming is always accessible and on demand. We operate absolutely free of charge for everyone, everywhere. If you love what we do, partner with us now by becoming an Israel News Talk Radio supporter. With your support, you'll be inscribed on our Israel News Talk Radio Wall of Fame. There's nothing like us in the world. Be part of something great. Israel News Talk Radio, straight talk from Israel.
Howdy, this is Rita from League City, Texas, now living in Israel. And though my heart may have belonged to Texas, it now belongs to Israel and all the fantastic show hosts at Israel News Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Michael Solomon from Kiryat Arba, Israel. And why do I love listening to Israel News Talk Radio? Because I love listening to the interesting interviews they do and their news reporting that most other media sources don't cover.
Hey, this is Nicole Eko from Malmo, Sweden. It gets pretty cold here in Sweden, so I love cuddling up with a warm cup of tea while I listen to Israel News Talk Radio.
Hey, everybody, this is Frank Karras from Tennessee. Me and my dog Buster really love listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
News, opinion, and more. You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.